change. One of these days.
Welcome, friends, to another edition of Economic Update. This is your weekly program of economic analysis, looking at the trends, the wages, the incomes, the debts, all those dimensions of our lives we call economic. I'm your host, Richard Wolff. I've been a professor of economics all my adult life, and I currently teach at the New School University in New York City. I want to jump right into the economic updates for today, and later in the program I'll talk about the websites and the communication that I hope you will entertain with us to help us shape these programs as we go through our economic lives. Well, the big news of this last week, or at least one of the big items, was the President's State of the Union message. President Obama, coming off the bad results, at least for his party, in the November 2014 elections, was scheduling and speculating, you might even say, on what he hoped to do in his remaining 2 years, and I think showed us that he wants to do something in the last 2 years a bit more progressive than what he was able to do or even sought to do in the first 6 years of his two terms. But I want to make a case that when he spoke about taxing the wealthy to do things for middle and working class people in the way of giving them tax breaks, of making community colleges free of charge to students and things like that, that he was actually carrying forward something that has emerged in the ranks not only of the Democratic Party, but in the ranks of leading segments of the business community as well. And it goes by a name, and I want to talk a little bit about it. It goes by the name inclusive capitalism. It was not just in Obama's State of the Union speech, but it was in a report, a quite famous report now, prepared by Larry Summers, the former Treasury Secretary and economic advisor to Obama, who wrote a report together with Ed Balls, who's a top Labour Party strategist in the United Kingdom. And indeed, that report came out of a conference in London in May of 2014, at which some of the people attending and participating were Mark Carney, the head of the Bank of England, Bill Clinton, I assume he doesn't need much explanation, and Eric Schmidt, the head of the Google Corporation. What are all these people concerned about? Well, they express enormous anxiety, as did the president, repeatedly, by the way, that the growing inequality of wealth and income is threatening capitalism as a system, not just this or that country's so-called recovery. And their argument is simple. It has two parts. One, if you make the mass of people poor relative to a tiny minority, they won't be able to have the money to buy the goods and services that businesses count on if they're going to make money. So it's self-defeating for capitalism. And their second argument is more interesting, I think, which is that capitalism itself is threatened if it is confronted by a mass of people who feel left out, who feel repressed, who feel denied the benefits of an economic system that seemed to go only to the tiny number at the top. So they propose an inclusive capitalism, a change, do more for the middle and the working classes, and even if it costs a little bit for the folks at the top, they will in the end be safer in their wealth at the top by sharing some of it than by grabbing it all and then risking what? Well, the unspoken term that they rarely talk about is the concept of revolution, which inserts itself into our daily discourse and consciousness a little more every day, which is itself a symptom of where we are. So let's talk a little bit about inclusive capitalism, whether it's the President's State of the Union message or these reports or the growing talk about it. First of all, this is a very old idea. We can go back many years to many times in history when the system becomes so unequal serves so few relative to the misery of so many that those at the top, at least some of them, become aware that they better do something, or else the goose that is laying the golden eggs, at least for them, will be killed. The best example I can think of is in the decade before the Russian Revolution of 1917, when several of the czars in Russia made the same insight that we could see coming to Larry Summers 100 years later. The insight is we've got to build up the middle class. A man named Stolypin, a minister in the government of the Tsar back around 1905, instituted a reform with much debate. The conservatives then didn't want to do it. He had to push it through to help the middle level of Russian society at the time. Give them some tax breaks. Give them some government incentives. Make it easier for them to be profitable, whether they were farmers or craftspersons and so on. To build up the middle class as the bulwark of Russian society. Translated into real English, build up the middle class so it becomes a political ally of those at the top rather than the ally of those at the bottom who want change, and thereby make your position more secure. The problem was the folks at the top didn't want to spend all that much money. They wanted to get the middle class, if you like, on the cheap, give them a little. And there the speech of President Obama is perfect. Do a little here, a little there. If you look at the numbers he proposed, the word modest doesn't get at it. It's a cheap attempt to try with a cheap outlay of money to keep the lid on a system whose inequality threatens to blow it apart. Did it work in Russia? No. The Russian Revolution in 1917 was the definitive answer to their effort on the cheap to win over the middle class. My guess for this year and for the times coming ahead is the same. If what Obama asks for, which barely is too little and too late, to save the middle class from the decimation it has gone through over the last 30 years. If that's what he proposes and the Republicans oppose that, so that whatever happens will be a watered-down version of what is too modest to begin with, then we're going to have cosmetic changes celebrated by the likes of Eric Schmidt, Bill Clinton, Larry Summers and company as a step in the right direction, because they don't dare say anything else of the sort, as I'm trying to get across here, that we're talking about way too little, coming way too late, to save this society from the social consequences of the kinds of inequality we are breeding and worsening with each passing week. And indeed, later in the program, we'll have an interview with a guest who will make that clear in yet other ways. The second big event, if you like, of the last week was the decision by the European Central Bank to commence a very energetic program of quantitative easing. That's the fancy term for printing more money, creating more money in the economy. And they're going to spend about $60 billion a month, reminiscent of the Federal Reserve's quantitative easing programs of recent memory. Indeed, what the European Central Bank is trying to do is to stimulate the seriously repressed, recession-prone European economy by doing what was done here in the United States. Since the United States is experiencing a quote-unquote recovery, the truth, of course, being, as we explain on this program every week almost, that the recovery here is for shareholders, for the stock market, for corporate profits at the top, but not for anybody else, because for everybody else, conditions continue basically to deteriorate. And the latest numbers on real wages and the latest numbers on unemployment bear that out. But it is good for those at the top who think that because they've recovered, everybody else has. And unfortunately, so many of the rest of us feel that there's something wrong with us that we haven't participated in the recovery, which is why I stress that the recovery has bypassed 80% of our people anyway. But the Europeans want at least that because they have not even been able to do that. So they're pumping money into the system. I want to go over with you what it means. The European central bank is literally going to print up money, paper money, but also create accounts and just put money into them, which they have the legal right to do. And what are they going to do with this extra money that they literally create electronically or physically? They're going to use it to buy the bonds of particular governments, whether it be France or Germany or whatever. And they're even going to buy bonds of major corporations. And when they do that, they pump this new money into the economy. And what's the goal of that? Well, what they say is we want to stimulate the economy. But that's a bizarre thing to say, because the effort of the United States' Federal Reserve, having done this for several years now, has not been to stimulate our economy. Nothing like what was promised. A slow, painful decline in the unemployment rate that has more to do with people leaving the labor force than with getting jobs. And the jobs they get are awful and do not suggest a long-term economic growth at all. So why would they copy? Well, there's something beautiful about printing money by the Central Bank of Europe, like with the Federal Reserve. That money goes into bank accounts. And what do the banks do with the money that is pumped into them as all this new money gets deposited in the bank? Well, they lend it out to the people they're most comfortable lending to. Those are the people who are the richest in our society, the safest people to lend to. And you know what they use the money for? The new money? To buy shares of stock from one another. That's why the stock market went up in the United States way more than the economic conditions of the vast majority of people. The extra money the Federal Reserve pumped in here, like the extra money that the European Central Bank will pump into Europe, will go into boosting their shares, boosting their stock market, boosting the wealth of those who have significant amounts of shares. And what's the other thing that pumping money in does? Well, it makes a signal to everybody, a signal that things are really bad in the world economy. Earlier last week, the Central Bank of Switzerland shocked everybody by suddenly declaring it's not going to keep the value of the Swiss franc related to the rest of the world's currencies the same because it is too expensive and too dangerous for Switzerland. Another sign that the world economy is in trouble. And they shook the world by deciding to change their policies. Well, what you see with the European Central Bank is the same anxiety about a world economy that's in terrible trouble. Europe is flirting with a real serious depression. It can't have any hope of selling its way out of it to the Chinese because they're slowing down. It can't have any hope of selling its way out of their problems by exporting to the United States because our economy can't afford to buy the stuff. That's why we have the problems we do in this country with an unemployment that remains 25 million people. If you add up the unemployed, those with part-time jobs who don't want them, and those who have left the labor force. So here's what's happening. In a desperate economic situation, people are moving money. Well, not people, rich people. The average person doesn't think about that, doesn't have money to move. But if you're wealthy, if you're a big corporation, if you're a wealthy individual, you have a lot of money, and now you have to be worried in a chaotic world economy. Where is your money located? If you're located in a place like Europe right now, you want to get out, because there's too much money being pumped into the economy and the value of the euro is going to go down. So where do you run to? You run to Switzerland. You run to Denmark. You run to places where you can keep your money, you hope, safe. And that disorients and destabilizes global currencies, which are bouncing around in a way we haven't seen in decades. Bottom line, we are all adjusting to changes that come from the fact that the wealthiest among us are hysterically frightened about what's going on, moving their money around, and we all have to live with the consequences. A European vacation, for example, just got much cheaper. On the other hand, we're going to sell many fewer goods, Americans are, in Europe, because they're going to have to spend more of their euros to get a dollar, making everything produced in dollars in the Americas more expensive. So our exports to Europe will go down, and that'll hurt our recovery, weak as it already is. So we're all going to live with the consequences, once again, of what the tiny group of people who are really wealthy are doing trying to find safety in an economic system, their behavior destabilizes every day. There's something absurd going on, and that's the bottom message you need to take away from what the president said and what is happening, because it's a capitalism in deep trouble trying to survive, whether it be with the individual capitalist or with these cosmetic efforts to help the middle class. I want to turn to a couple of other updates. I had to cut short the number I could do with you today because of these big events, the European Central Bank pumping money and the State of the Union message. But two more are so important I have to go through them with you. First, this is the weekend of the great Greek election that everybody has been paying attention to. This Sunday is the day. And it looks like, from the polls, that the left-wing Syriza party, one of whose basic positions is that Greece cannot and should not pay off the debts that have been accumulated over the last 20, 30 years because they were not done properly, they were done in the interest of a tiny minority, and they're now the burden of the vast majority, and that is unacceptable democratically or in terms of the economic lives of a country as badly hit over the last 5 years as Greece has been. I won't go over all of that. We've done that in previous programs. But one of the great scare tactics designed to get people not to vote for Syriza has been the claim, coming above all from Germany and from Angela Merkel's government, that Greece must pay its debts, that it is impossible for a country not to pay its debts. That's a violation of the basic obligations that borrowers and lenders have to one another, and so on and so on and so on. I wanted to put that in a context. This German demand, led by Germany, but other countries agreeing, that the Greeks must pay, you cannot forgive debts, etc. Here's a little history, folks. In 1953, Germany, having lost World War II, on top of having lost World War I earlier, was burdened with an enormous debt, and the German government of 1953 said, we can't do it. We need help. And you know what they asked for? They asked for their debts to be forgiven. They asked in 1953 for exactly what Greece is asking in 2015. A conference was convened in London. And in the summer of 1953, after meeting for 6 months, an agreement was reached, the London Agreement on Germany's external debts. And let me tell you what the Germans fought for and what they got. A reduction of their outstanding debts, mostly to U.S., British, and French governments and private banks. A reduction of their debt by 50%. Let me be clear here again. The German debt was reduced by 50%. The rest of the German debt, the other 50%, were stretched out. Instead of being due in a 2, 3, 4 years, they were stretched out over 30 years, effectively relieving the German government of any debt at all. Very little, stretched out over 30 years. The Germans fought for and got what they now don't want to permit to Greece. You need to understand that history in order to appreciate what is going on now. Finally, for today, I thought the following two extremes about American housing markets right now says more about where we are as an economy than a ream of statistics. First, from The Gothamist, a very important blog that keeps track of economic things here in New York City, The Gothamist, a story on January 17th by Ben Yakas, reports on the most expensive transaction for an apartment in New York City in the history of New York City in the United States. At 157, that's the name of an apartment building, the top two floors, 11,000 square feet to be precise, was sold this last week for $100,471,000. You heard right. An apartment changed hands for $100 million. It comes to, for those of you that keep track of such things, $9,000 per square foot of this apartment. astonishing. The other side of the same story. In 2014, there were 1,120,000 home foreclosures in the United States. That's right, 1,120,000 families found themselves pushed out of their home with their home put up for auction. In 12 states, 2014 had more foreclosures than the previous year. It's not getting better in those 12 states. And by the way, those 12 states include, just so you know how widespread the foreclosure crisis is, Wyoming, Idaho, North Carolina, New York, Oregon, Massachusetts, Maryland, Montana, Alaska, District of Columbia, Mississippi, and the worst state in the union for foreclosures, New Jersey. Wow. And a recovery? Really? The last year, before this crisis hit, 2006, we had 700,000 foreclosures. Nothing to be proud of. But last year, when we were supposed to have recovered, did we have less than the 700,000 we had in 2006? No, as I just told you, we had 1,120,000. No recovery, folks, except for those at the top who buy and sell apartments for tens and now even hundreds of millions of dollars. That's the reality. The rest is PR, and I'm being as polite in calling it that as I know how. Well, let's turn then to some of the questions you've asked about. And the one I think I'm going to focus on in the time that we have was the actions of the Swiss National Bank this last week. Here's what has gone on in Switzerland. Switzerland is a small economy, but very rich. And it's very rich mostly because of its banking. But it has some industry, pharmaceuticals, watches, chocolate, things like that, that you're all familiar with, or at least I assume most of you are. And what the Swiss had been doing is dealing with Europe, the place where they do most of their economic transactions, by keeping an equal amount of ratio between the value of the Swiss franc and the value of the euro, that is the common currency for most of the rest of Europe. Not all of it, but for most of it. And what this meant was that the Swiss were worried that as the capitalist crisis got worse, and let me underscore that because the Swiss banks keep track of the world's economy better and more than most others. As they saw it getting worse, that's what they say, getting worse, not recovery, getting worse, they began to notice that more and more rich Europeans, and indeed not a small number of rich Americans and rich British, were moving their wealth out of their own currency, euros, dollars, pounds sterling, and buying instead Swiss francs. They noticed that Swiss has been an independent safe haven, neutral in both world wars, unwilling to get involved in the struggles of the world, a place that becomes wealthy by being the place where rich people keep their wealth. Rich companies, rich individuals. So more and more people were buying Swiss currency, but there wasn't enough Swiss currency to go around for all the rich who wanted to park their money there. So the danger for the Swiss was that the people wanting to stay in Switzerland to be safe would bid up the value of the Swiss currency because they were desperate to keep their wealth safe. And that wouldn't be good for Switzerland. Why not? Because it would make it more expensive for anybody to buy Swiss goods because they're priced in Swiss francs. And if you have to pay more of your currency to get a Swiss franc, it makes the article produced in Switzerland more expensive. So Switzerland wouldn't be able to sell its drugs or its watches or other commodities. And the Swiss struggled with that. On the one hand, they have to be the safe haven because that's in the end where their wealth depends. They have to be the place where you can hide your money, squirrel away your money, keep it safe. So they have to let this happen. So what they did is they printed more and more euros and gave them to all the people who wanted them, took in all that other currency. But as they took in all the other currency of the Europeans and the Americans and the British who wanted to unload their currencies for safety, they were finding themselves printing more and more money, and that got scary because they were giving away their francs to get currencies whose long-term prospects don't look so good. And that's when they decided this last week they couldn't do it anymore. They've been doing it for too many years, but the prospects of the world economy are so poor in the minds of the Swiss bankers that they dare not accumulate more of the rest of the world's currencies, because like the rest of the world, they want to keep it in Switzerland because it's safer there. They don't want to hold those others. They were caught. So they said, we've had it, we're not doing it anymore. That was a panicked reaction, but it's a sign of a deteriorating world economy. So panicked was it that the next morning after the Swiss National Bank announced its action, Christine Lagarde, the head of the International Monetary Fund, gave a press conference in which she publicly complained of not having been informed of the action of the Swiss National Bank. That's kind of unheard of. That's the sign that the people running the program are more scared about the world economy than we are, and way more scared than what they're letting on. It's a lesson. It's an important lesson to learn. Last economic update for this first half of the program, before we turn to the interview that will occupy us in the second half. Several of you this last week sent me questions asking, could I please give the latest details on the distribution of wealth in the world? How has that been going? Well, it so happened that last week a report was issued by Oxfam, O-X-F-A-M, a very well-respected British agency that keeps records and track of this world wealth. And they've been warning about the growing inequality, and indeed have been one of the lead people making this claim. They're famous for their work on world poverty, but they expanded that to become a monitor, if you like, of world wealth. And their report is so stunning that I thought I'd share it with you. The report was issued January 2015. Anyone wants to follow it, just look up Oxfam, O-X-F-A-M, and you can find the report and get the details yourself. But here are the nodules of insight that their research shows. And the numbers are a little bit complicated, but stay with me. I think you'll see why they're important. First and most important, by 2016, that's next year, if the current trends that have been going on for 25 years continue, if those current trends continue, the richest 1% of people on our planet Earth will have more wealth than the other 99%. So let me do this again. The 1% richest people on the planet will have more wealth as a group than the other 99%. It's staggering. In fact, if you take the top 20% of people on this planet, they have 95% of the wealth. And the other 80% of us share the remaining 5%. Let's do it again. The top 20% of folks have 95% of the wealth in the world. And the other 80% of us share the remaining 5%. The vast majority have relatively nothing compared to a tiny minority who have it all. There's no comment I can make that would get beyond just telling you that, but I will give you one more in the report. The 80 richest people, the 80, not 100, not 1,000, not a million, the 80 richest people on the world today have the same amount of wealth as the poorest half of our planet. So let me do it again. The 80 richest people have the same amount of wealth as 3.5 billion people on this planet. Every church, every synagogue, every mosque, every moral fiber in a decent person around the world can only say there is no justification for a capitalism that produces that kind of outcome. It is the definitive critique of the system. We're going to take our break in the middle of the program. Please come back when we will have an interview that examines how all of this impacts children. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
more. I need her tenderness. Put me on the critical list. Well, all I need.
Welcome
is
again. This is your host, Richard Wolf. This is a program we bring you every week. And in this program today, we're going to be interviewing a guest. Her name is Dr. Harriet Fraud, and before I introduce her formally to you, let me welcome you, Dr. Fraud, to the program.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Fraud is a mental health counselor and a hypnotherapist with a very active practice in Manhattan in New York City. She is also the author of many articles in a variety of places, but particularly the independent news service truthout.org. And she writes about the psychological and family implications of social structures and social change. Today, I've asked Dr. Fraud to come and join us because I want to look at, and I want her expertise at, dealing with how the economic conditions, the crisis, the recession, whatever it's called, particularly of the last 6 or 7 years, but even beyond that, how it has affected a part of our society that economists too infrequently examine and look at, namely children. So I want to get right into it by asking Dr. Fraud, tell us something about both the broad and the particular impacts of the recession, of this capitalist economic system's workings on the children in our society.
Well, children are particularly vulnerable. They don't give large sums of money to candidates in our society. They also don't vote. Of course, most of the new electorate doesn't vote either, but, you know, children are excluded per se. And they have been perhaps the hardest hit of all. Over half of American children in public schools are poor. They qualify for free school lunch. The highest income you can have for a family of four to qualify for free school lunch is $43,000 a year for a family of four.
In other words, half of our school kids are in a family that is that below is that
poor.
Level.
That's right. That is at or below that level, mainly below. This is a huge, huge increase. In 1995, less than a third of public school children were poor. Now it's over half. So that's enormous. That's not a recovery.
Right.
That's the impact of the recession. And let's look at it in kids' most basic needs that they need to survive. One of them is physical safety. Kids have to be safe. They can't be injured and hurting and sick. Well, safety has been hit hard, literally hit hard. With every spike in unemployment comes a spike in what they call subdural hemorrhaging or under the skull hemorrhaging caused by shaken baby syndrome, where you shake a child's head so violently
that you injure them,
that they become blind, retarded, or dead. And that happens when parents' frustrations mount to the point where they can't stand a baby's cry. And I have an unemployed client who with whom I did hypnotherapy, because his wife sent him in because he, every time the baby wouldn't stop crying, he'd say, "I'll kill it, I'll kill it." Yeah. And his wife didn't want him to babysit for obvious reasons. At any rate, in hypnotism, when it turned out that he was the child who wouldn't stop crying, he couldn't stand his own crying, that had been a remnant from his own violent childhood, but also from feeling valueless because he was unemployed. And it's not only...
So there are clear, I don't mean to interrupt, but there
sure.
are clear statistics that indicate that when you have a recession, when you have an economic downturn and unemployment goes up, the incidence of this kind of abuse of children shoots up with the unemployment numbers. In other words, they
yes.
move together.
All child abuse has surged. Child abuse decreases at age 6 when kids have to be out of the house
and go to school
for several hours a day and go to school. So that it's mostly children under 6 who are abused. But parents who are frustrated and angry and demoralized have very few people to take it out on, and there are the children, very handily. So that child abuse and child deaths have surged. However, it's not only young children who are suffering and who are unsafe. The numbers of throwaways and runaways have also surged. There's a good article in the Times, and it's entitled, it's based on a study. Sorry for rustling my pages to read the name of the study, but I want you to know the article is saying recession drives surge in youth runaways. Runaways are children who run away overwhelmingly because they're raped, beaten, tortured, starved. They range from about 12 to 18 years old. Throwaways are differentiated from runaways because they're thrown out. They too range from 12 years old to 18. They're rarely reported missing because their parents don't want them back. And they try to survive. The most common survival mechanism is prostitution, because there are legitimate outlets. Even for 18-year-olds, the unemployment rate is 70%, so that's not very promising. They're on the streets where they're used by pimps, or they eke out a living through stealing, begging, etc. What's very interesting is that nationally they've formed collectives where the groups of maybe 15 or 20 kids live under a highway or in a under a bridge in some place where the authorities won't find them. And what's interesting is that the kind of discussions they have, there's a discussion that they mention at a collective of 20 kids.
This is
where a 12-year-old wants to join their group. "We keep running into this," said one of the boys, Clinton Ankers, age 18. "Over the past year," he said, "he and five other teenagers living together on the streets have taken under their wings no fewer than 20 children, some as young as 12, and taught them how to avoid predators and the police, how to survive the cold and find food. We have very few refuges for throwaways and runaway children."
And where did this take place that you're reading to us?
In Oregon. This is a story in Medford, Oregon, about this particular haven. However, they're found in New York City. They're found all over the place. Right. There's an enclave in Tompkins Square Park. They're all over the city, where kids band together in collectives. The way they report this is they have this 12-year-old who could be reported missing, so she could endanger their group because the police might actually try to come and find her or notice a kid walking around. And the Clinton Ankers, who was kind of in charge, said, "Okay, this is a decision for the group. Should we take her in? On the one hand, she'll be out there and easy prey at 12 and a girl. On the other hand, she's a magnet for the cops." And so this is what's happening with thousands and thousands of children. So much for physical safety. Now, another basic need is shelter. The number of U.S. homeless children has doubled from 1.6 million to 2.5 million since the recession. One out of 30 U.S. kids is homeless due to foreclosures, due to high rents, due to the poverty of their parents. And so they live wherever they can on the streets. Children, I worked with homeless children. When children usually make a picture and they're about 7 or 8, they draw a line, which is the ground, and they have the little house on the line, the tree on the line, and so on. Homeless children have everything in the air because there's no settling down. It means they can't really go to school because they don't have a home address. And they are constantly foraging and terrified because they're easy prey living on the streets. And if they go into shelters, which some of them do, they're easy prey in the shelter. So, you know, we're talking about kids with inadequate shelter. And inadequate shelter means that even kids who are not homeless but are poor, and that's half of American kids, most often live in poor neighborhoods where there aren't upkept programs, where there aren't safe streets, where they're in danger. People who are poor can't afford childcare if they have jobs, so they stay alone. Most crimes perpetrated by children and against children happen in that time period between when schools are let out and when parents return, times that other countries protect children. Now let's go on to nutrition, which is, these are the basic needs for survival.
I just want to remind folks that the point of this is to get a sense, not just a statistical, but also in depth, of what it means to allow a society to experience the level of economic non-production unemployment. You know, it is a question of understanding that throughout this crisis, President Obama, the Congress, could have taken the unemployed people, put them to work with what we know are unused machines, unutilized production space, office space, store space, and given them jobs to produce the wealth that could solve the problems of poverty, could rebuild our cities, and give them a decent income and a job. We chose not to do that at the expense, among other things, of a generation of young people. And that's really what you're documenting.
And of our future.
As a nation.
As a nation, because these children are the future of America. These starved, homeless, poor, struggling, denied children. 16 million kids at the moment are hungry. 20% of kids, that's one out of five, in 37 states and the District of Columbia, Washington, D.C., side of our government, go hungry.
And tell us what that means exactly.
Well, what it means is that it means a lot of things, but it means that they're distracted in school. A friend of mine who's a school teacher goes to the day-old bakery and gets baked goods, and also she brings in gallons of milk for her whole class because so many of the kids can't concentrate because they're hungry.
My guess is she uses her own money to do this?
She uses her own money because the schools don't have a breakfast program, even in areas where they desperately need it. And she finds that the kids are less disruptive and less dazed if they have some milk and a day-old pastry. And she gives them to everyone in the class rather than single out who's poor, which would be a daily humiliation. And it's part of their school day. One out of four American children, one out of five, excuse me, has pizza as a meal at least once a day. Pizza is carbs, fat, and salt. And pizza is a meal for people, you know, can get a dollar a slice. It's cheap, and it has no nutrition, and it's easy for people who come home from work exhausted and haven't the energy or the hope to do something about adequate nutrition for their children. American children eat junk food in great quantities because they're home alone. They're home alone because there are no programs. The streets are unsafe for the half of American children who don't have the money to live in a kind place. And they eat junk food. There was a study done in which bags of junk food and what children eat is equivalent to a cup of lentils eaten by a starving Nigerian child in terms of its nutritional value. So it not only leaves the children hungry, but also obese. One out of three American children is overweight or obese.
If I could just interrupt, let me be the economist here.
Right.
I want everyone listening, everyone viewing, to understand that the capitalist private economic system, the market system we talk about, produces at great profit the junk food shoveled into these kids and doesn't produce the funds in the school to provide better nutrition, the education in the system to teach people not to depend on fat and salt for their diet. So we have to see this as one of the consequences by which we evaluate the desirability, efficiency, and effectiveness of the economic system we live with, rather than pretending it's the source of all kinds of wonderful innovation by deftly avoiding facing these realities, which are just as much a product of this system as anything at the other end that we like to talk about.
Very much a product. So that, and it's someone like Michelle Obama can tout healthy food when in poor neighborhoods you can't get healthy food because the big store chains close down, and fruit, fresh fruit and vegetables are very expensive, and there is no subsidy. And so that, and there isn't compensation in terms of snacks and education and meals at schools. They're always cutting down because the food industry, in a lovely capitalist example, wants to, and under Reagan succeeded in getting ketchup to be called a vegetable. And so that children don't even get nutrition when it's subsidized often. And so that you're also talking about giving the children of the future diabetes, endocrine difficulties. These are the things that come with being fat. And one out of three American kids are fat. And later, heart disease and cancer.
Because of the interest of time, I wish we had more. Let me take the conversation in another direction. And we obviously won't get to everything, and we can bring you back. Tell us a little bit about how at least some other countries in the world have managed the lives of their children without these kinds of horror stories, to be blunt.
Well, we're at the bottom of the 14 wealthier OECD, you know, nations, the wealthier nations of the world. We're at the bottom in terms of what we give to children. And so that we could look at a nation that really does subsidize its children, let's say like Norway. In Norway, if you're a single parent, you get first choice of housing, you get excellent child care for your child, you get a very liberal maternity leave. United States is the only country in the world, except for Somalia and Swaziland, that doesn't, and Papua New Guinea, that doesn't give a paid maternity leave to mothers. And paid
as a matter of right and
as
law.
As a matter of right and law. And also, we have the least vacation time that is paid of any industrialized country, so that parents don't have time to bond with their children. We have the most single parents and the least subsidy. Now, you could look at a very privileged country like Norway, which goes way out of its way, or you could look at a country like France, in which about the same number of children as in the United States, about a quarter, a little less, are born poor. However, child care is free starting at 3 years old in France, whereas it costs between $5,000 and $25,000 a year to have your child in a decent child care center in the United States. French daycares are governmental organizations in special little beautiful houses with trained personnel. And 85% of U.S. kids have substandard care. And what does that mean? It means that your infant is parked in an apartment in front of a TV, sitting in a wet diaper, between the ages of 0 and 2, which are the prime years of brain development. So you're basically deadening the brains of your future generations of children. 85% of daycare in the United States is substandard because people can't afford it. There goes capitalism. You know, there you go. And in France, you get a clothing allowance for your school-age child. And every neighborhood has a center for school-age children as well as after-school programs and weekend programs. If you have an infant, you pay $1 an hour for the most quality child care center. You have a liberal maternity leave, and an aide comes to your house free as a matter of the government's course to help you manage your child or to babysit so you can go out and do something else and to help you get back into shape physically so that, you know, you have a very different system. In every little rural town, there's a sports center where people can be taken on free buses after school and go and play. And there are study rooms. You know, it's the United States is the worst in these things.
It's an extraordinary story. I wish we had more time. We don't. We've run out of time. Let me please ask you to consider coming back and continuing this conversation. I can't resist making a comment listening to you. This is a society that savages its children.
Yes. You've
just shown us that. It's also a society that talks endlessly, more than I hear in any other country in the world, about its commitment to family values. That is so stark a contradiction, so stark a suggestion to us that we need badly to rethink the kind of economic system that supports a whole industry of claiming family values while it in actuality is as destructive of the family as any force one could identify in modern culture.
Totally. You know, one of the things, the people who most espouse family values are the same ones who urge the United States not to subsidize child care, after school care, weekend care, summer camps, nutritional values, and help for children across the board. And it was Reagan, the hero of the right wing, who vetoed Head Start for All American Children on the basis that it defied family values.
It's extraordinary. It really is extraordinary. Folks, we've come to the end of a program, Economic Update, that we will be bringing you, as you know, every week. I wanted to remind you, please, to note that we maintain two websites where these kinds of programs are archived and also where a great deal more material along just the lines we're exploring today is available to you 24/7 without any charge whatsoever. The websites are rdwolf.com and democracyatwork.info. Not only are those websites available to you with much material about all of this, but they also allow you to do two other things I'd like to invite you to do. Number one, communicate with us. What other kinds of interviews might you like? Do you like the program? Would you like different things? Etc., etc. It's a way for us to build this program around your interests and your needs. And the second thing you can do is follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Pinterest, and so be involved in our work on an ongoing basis that we urge and invite you to do. I want to thank truthout.org, that remarkable independent source of news and analysis every day, in which both Dr. Frod and I publish work from time to time. I also want you to be aware that I speak around the country and that if you would be interested in having me do that in your area, please get in touch with us through the websites. And finally, this is a program about sharing insights into the way economic life is evolving. Please become a partner. Tell people through your own social media and word-of-mouth networks about the program, about what you learn here, so that we can have the biggest possible impact on how these problems are going to be struggled with and coped with and overcome by the people of this country and the people of the world who are entering a time, it is no exaggeration for me to say, of extraordinarily difficult economic conditions. When the people at the top are as frightened as today's headlines indicate them to be, whether it's the Swiss National Bank roiling the currency markets, or the President of the United States in the State of the Union message telling us all that we're becoming a nation of rich and poor on a scale that threatens our community's survival, you know that for the rest of us, not at the top, cushioned by wealth, these are hard times. And they're not going to get better anytime soon, no matter what glad-handing politician is talking to you. Thank you for being with us. I look forward to speaking with you again next week on Economic Update.
My time, babe. They ain't gonna change. Change, change, change. Change, change, change.